Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a 289-137 vote in the House today on a GOP bill, the American Security Against Foreign Enemies Act, or SAFE Act of 2015, aimed at pausing the admission of refugees from Syria, which passed with the help of 47 Democrats joining the Republicans with enough votes to override a promised veto from the White House. Elise Foley, the immigration and politics reporter with the Huffington Post who covered the vote today, joins us to assess the fate of the bill in the Senate and explain why so many Democrats ignored Obama's admonition against victimizing the victims of ISIS, the Syrian refugees he described as, quote, the most vulnerable people in the world. Then we will speak with John Mueller, a political scientist at Ohio State University and the Cato Institute, about his new book, Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism, and the reflexive tendency of America's politicians and the press to overreact to provocations from terrorist groups like the Islamic State, which just released a cheesy video threatening to blow up Times Square. We will discuss how the free publicity given to this ludicrously amateurish bombast from ISIS trivializes real threats and undermines national security as recurring hysteria prompts the authorities to cry wolf too often. Then finally, we'll examine whether the attacks in Paris that were designed by the Islamic State to show it had the power to influence, if not dominate, the G20 summit in Turkey may end up forcing a consensus among the powers involved to solidify an anti-ISIS coalition. Henri Barki, the director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, joins us to discuss his latest article at the American Interest, From Sinjar to Paris and Back, and whether recent events have put the U.S. in a stronger position to get cooperation from recalcitrant allies. And joining us now is Elise Foley, an immigration and politics reporter for the Huffington Post. Previously, she worked as a reporter at the Washington Independent, and her latest article at the Huffington Post is Senate Dems Try to Shift Focus from Syrian Refugees by Backing Visa Waiver Limits. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elise Foley.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the vote today was a pretty substantial vote on this rather loftily named bill, American Security Against Foreign Enemies Act, or SAFE Act of 2015. Of course, the president couldn't be framing it in a more different light. He's making moral appeals, castigating politicians, particularly those that are seeking votes, victimizing the most vulnerable people in the world, as he said. So where do you think is this a case of politicians getting cover in case something does happen? Do you think that's what's happening here?
I think that it's certainly partially that. I mean, I think what happens is something terrible happens and everybody feels this desire, you know, I need to do something. But politicians feel it extra because they have all their constituents calling and saying, what's going to happen? And so quickly after this attack, people started talking about Syrian refugees. So you had a whole lot more people, I think, than were aware of the program previously who heard about the program. They started calling all these offices and they want to tell their representatives that they're doing something. Michael McCaul, who's one of the people who introduced the bill, he's the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the House, said explicitly to reporters that they wanted to do something before Thanksgiving, so they did this. So I think it's to show it got this, you know, it got pretty good support, and I think that a decent chunk of the point was just to show, look, we've heard you, we're doing something, don't worry, we're on it.
So, in other words, it's the American people's concerns, or if you like, hysteria that's driving this. My sense was that
to some degree, but I mean, I don't think people would have necessarily thought of it if it hadn't been put in their heads by politicians.
Right.
So it's sort of a cycle, I think.
Right. Well, I was just thinking, though, that Obama, being a lame duck, can take a moral position and doesn't have to worry. But if something were to happen, then the politicians who voted this way would have political cover. I mean, in other mm-hmm. words, if somebody came into the country, which, according to all the authorities, is highly unlikely, that the screening process is quite rigorous. I take it those arguments didn't fly.
Yeah, well, one thing that's interesting in, with regards to what you were saying on cover is that the way that this bill is written, a lot of it is about just shifting the cover away from politicians and onto the intelligence directors, the FBI director, Department of Homeland Security, by making what the bill does is make them sign off on each and every person. So it's really basically just designed to say, look, if you want to let these people in, that's on you. We want everyone to know that's on you. It's not our fault. So if something happens, they can say that. And so I think that's a lot of it is just trying not to have that aspect on them if there was anything that went wrong.
So what is then I take it the attitude in the Senate, though, is that we're going away for these Thanksgiving vacations, and by the time we get back, cooler heads will prevail, and this is going to go nowhere. Is that what you're hearing on the Senate side?
To some degree, although it's always something where things could always change, so it's hard to make clear predictions. But usually how it goes in the House is the one that often acts really quickly, and then the Senate is the one that moves slower and, you know, requires a little bit more cooperation between the two sides. And so I do think that what you'll see from the Senate might be a more measured response. You're going to continue to have Republicans, I think, since some of them are running for president, Republican senators pushing these extreme proposals that are even more extreme than what the House passed. But I think that if we do see an actual bill out of the Senate, or the Senate does take up this House bill, I think they're more likely to amend it to make it a little bit more to maybe Obama's liking. I don't know if that's possible to do, but I certainly think it's likely that it would be more moderate, because it has to be more moderate, or they need some Democratic votes. They can't get it through the Senate without them.
Sure. Well, again, I'm speaking with Elise Foley, who's an immigration and politics reporter for The Huffington Post. Previously, she worked as a reporter at The Washington Independent. And her latest article at The Huffington Post is House Dems Back GOP on Bill to Pause Admittance of Some Refugees. They supported the legislation despite White House opposition. And that's, of course, the 47 defectors, if you want. At least I'm sure that's how the White House sees it, who voted with the Republican majority on this bill that was called the American Security Against Foreign Enemies Act of 2005, the American SAFE Act, which essentially puts a hold or a freeze or a pause, as they say, on accepting refugees from Syria. And the U.S. is, compared to the rest of the Europeans who are taking in literally millions, the U.S. has taken in about 2,500 refugees from Syria since 2011, and the Obama administration has announced a plan to accept 10,000 more in the coming year. And the White House says that half of these refugees admitted to the U.S. are children, and about a quarter are older than 60. So was there any discussion in defense of letting these people in, that pointing out that these people are actually victims of the Islamic State just as much as the people in Paris are victims of the Islamic State?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you had a lot of Democrats even who supported this bill who were saying that, and a lot of them were saying that this is a very intensive screening process. So I think that there are a lot of people out there, pointing out that the screening process is rigorous. There are a lot of people saying, you know, all these arguments, such as these are people who are vulnerable. We're not bringing in, usually military-aged men. There are obviously some military-aged men refugees, but that point about older people, children, that there are, just all sorts of reasons why it's good for national security to not have a ton of people in refugee camps overseas, not give ISIS some sort of propaganda material by having all this rhetoric that's against Muslims. All of these points are getting put out there. I think that they are just, to some degree, or at least in certain circles or certain TV stations or what have you, are getting drowned out by this fear of, of this potential of an attack, even if Democrats are pointing out over and over that that's unlikely. It's just not, doesn't seem to be entirely getting through yet.
So some of the Democrats that you quoted in your article, Elise Foley, who voted with the Republicans, Representative Jerry Connolly, a Democrat of Virginia, Steve Israel, a Democrat of New York, and Patrick Maloney, a Democrat of New York as well. It seems that most of them are basically saying that the White House didn't make a good enough case, that the people that came to brief them simply didn't make a good case, and that almost implying that somehow the White House wasn't full-throated in its support for the Syrian refugees. Is that the impression you got?
You know, I don't necessarily think it was that they weren't full-throated in support of Syrian refugees, because I do think that Obama does seem to have been very firm, both publicly and I think behind the scenes, about the desire to bring in Syrian refugees. I don't think that they're wavering on that. I think that the frustration is that they're not making a better case. These Democrats are frustrated that the administration hasn't explained better to the public how the refugee system works. So they, you know, want everybody to know that this is a really strenuous process. You have a lot of people out there saying, these people aren't vetted at all. We just let people in. We don't even vet them. And implying that there's, you know, nothing being done, when really it's an 18 to 24 month process. So what some of them were saying is, okay, well, when you hear it explained, it does sound pretty good, but we don't have enough people explaining it. So I think that that was a lot of the frustration, is that the White House hasn't done enough to make it so that they would feel that it was palatable to their constituents for them to vote for it. So they, you know, they decided not to. And then I think they also just weren't convinced that it was as bad as what the White House said it was. They thought that, you know, the White House says it's this horrible thing that's going to stop everything. I don't think that it would necessarily have to stop everything. So I think that they weren't convinced on that point. But I don't think it was necessarily out of a not understanding the need to help Syrian refugees.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Elise Foley, do you think that the president himself, the extent to which when he spoke yesterday in the Philippines and really castigated, not by name, but Senator Ted Cruz for saying that we only should take Christians in, which I think also Jeb Bush said as well in a similar kind of vein. And he just really laid into the idea that these politicians are stoking all this fear in order to get votes, and that it's essentially immoral to beat up on these weak people. And these are the same people, he said, that are afraid of journalists asking them tough questions in a presidential debate, yet that they're prepared to beat up on, you know, widows and orphans and people escaping the horrors of Syria. It prompted, of course, Ted Cruz, who certainly knew he was that Obama was directing the remarks at him, sort of challenge him, you know, like a gunfighter, come and say it to my face, you know. So do you think that the president's contempt for some of these Republicans is sort of affecting this vote?
I think that it's possible. I think in terms of his response, he has said things about how, you know, we're open to looking at tightening security, you know, screenings for refugees in the ways that we can. But for the most part, he's really dismissed the idea that something is needed with the Syrian refugee resettlement program. I'm not saying necessarily that anything actually is, but I think that maybe they might have underestimated the amount that argument would stick with people. And maybe should have taken it more seriously from the beginning, and really from the beginning explained better, you know, this is why this isn't needed, versus kind of going after Republicans for suggesting it. I do think that, you know, there are some differences between wanting a screening system to be different than, you know, banning all refugees or banning Muslim refugees specifically and only letting in Christians. So I think that there are a lot of different things in there. But, I mean, certainly he definitely has been very, very harsh on Republicans. And I think it's something that it almost seems personal for him. I think it's just such a big thing for him to make that commitment for 10,000. And I just don't think he's wanting to back down from it. I think he sees it as a moral issue.
Right, but they've basically got the votes to override a veto. So in practical terms, there's not much you can do except hope that this bill dies in the Senate, right?
Right. And I think that in the Senate, Harry Reid, the minority leader, said today that the bill won't get through the Senate. You know, he doesn't control the Senate anymore. But if he can keep all the Democrats together, which I don't know whether he could or couldn't, but if he could, then they could block the bill. I think that they are hoping to change course and try and focus on something else. But yeah, I mean, if the bill does go to Obama's desk as is and he vetoes it, then it's possible that they could override that veto, and it would go into effect anyway. I don't know whether Democrats would be as willing to override a veto as they were to vote to pass the bill, but I don't know if we'll find out. We'll have to find out.
I see. Well, Elise Foley, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Elise Foley, who's an immigration and politics reporter for The Huffington Post. Previously, she worked as a reporter at The Washington Independent, and her latest article at The Huffington Post is House Dems Back GOP on Bill to Pause Admittance of Some Refugees. They supported the legislation despite White House opposition. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the extent to which our politicians and the press reflexively overreact to provocations from terrorist groups like the Islamic State that just released a cheesy video threatening to blow up Times Square.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. John Mueller, who's a political scientist at Ohio State University and the Cato Institute, whose research areas include international relations, security studies, risk analysis, public opinion, foreign policy, terrorism and counterterrorism, and the history of dance. He's the author of Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefit, and Costs of Homeland Security. And his latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mueller.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And I was watching both CNN and MSNBC last night when they presented this latest video from Daesh, the Islamic State, that was absolutely cheesy. It wasn't like a B-movie. It was like a D-movie of stock footage of Times Square and some guy putting explosive vest and zipping up a leather jacket, and I couldn't believe how dumb and amateurish the movie was or the video clip, and yet you had all this breathless reportage from all the reporters and waiting for a press conference from Bill Bratton, the chief of police of New York, as though this was some great tectonic moment, and you know, it's like, it just feels like they're jerking our chain and the press are acting like the publicity department for some, you know, D-movie studio.
Yeah, well, it's not new. It just, there's a tendency whenever these terrorism cases burst and pop up, rather, in the United States, that there's an awful lot of hype around it as they hold press conferences to announce what they've just done. And then once you look into the cases more, they tend to be fairly comparatively minor and often even pathetic. For example, there's one case of seven guys who were sort of marching around in a windowless shack in Miami, and they were trying to con a guy that they thought was an Al-Qaeda operative in order to give him more money. And they talked about launching a full-scale war against the United States, these seven guys, all of them unemployed at the time. And that was reported seriously, that somehow that's how dangerous these guys are going to launch a full-scale war, all seven of them. And that's really quite typical in these cases.
Well, I remember a long time back, the FBI had got a bunch of, I think, Jamaicans and Haitians down in Florida. And these guys were just like what you described. They were absolutely stoned on marijuana and rambling on about blowing up, I think it was the Sears Tower in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And they put them away for decades. I mean,
yes, right.
But that's not what I'm talking about in this case. This is a propaganda piece produced by Daesh, by the Islamic State, that our media obligingly gives airtime to and then gets into a complete lather about it.
Yeah, well, that's what I said. They've done in the other ones as well. Yeah, you'd think there'd be some skepticism and some sort of chiding of it. On the other hand, of course, going along with that flow, it tends to help boost ratings, and people seem to love to be scared and turn off if you sort of suggest that maybe you shouldn't be scared about something. So it does seem to be pretty natural in the media. That just the phrase, trying to work into every case, the word ISIS, if at all possible. They find some case somewhere or other, and they try to figure out, well, this is sort of like ISIS in the sense that it bears its thumbprints or something like that, or they did something like this, you know, 4 years ago or something. That same thing happened with Al-Qaeda, about Al-Qaeda's footprints or fingerprints are all over this, and mostly it's insofar as there's comparisons, they're very trivial.
Well, your new book, Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism, which co-authored with Mark Stewart, John Mueller, you say that early reports estimated slightly more than 300 Al-Qaeda operatives living in the United States, and it wasn't long before this number became 2,000 or 5,000 domestic terrorists. And these estimates snowballed, and so did spending on federal counterterrorism, and now it totals over $1 trillion. That's what I find most depressing about this whole latest enemy, public enemy number one, the Islamic State. You know, if it wasn't for the fact that they executed and beheaded those hostages on television, I think we'd be well out of that region. And that's what Obama was trying to do. And this very act on television just got the media so carried away, and then by extension the public, that now you've got this clamor, now particularly following the massacres in Paris, to send boots on the ground. The politicians, particularly those running for president, are screaming from the rafters about boots on the ground. And you just feel like, what is wrong with us as a nation? Are we so immature and so insecure, even though we're the world's number one superpower, that any crackpot from the Middle East can rattle our chain and we just obligingly send armies in?
Well, the national anthem does end with the four words, home of the brave, so maybe we need some reconsideration of that. The beheadings were really startling because there were, I looked at the poll data on that, and after ISIS took over Mosul, there was very little support for sending boots on the ground. Once the hostages were killed, which is not an act of great military prowess, I mean, it's a horrible thing, obviously, but beheading a defenseless hostage is not exactly a sign of a great, great macho capacity. But after that happened, there was this huge increase in the public, basically saying this is a major security threat to the United States. Not that's obviously a security threat to the people in the area, but to the United States, and boosting support for boots on the ground from around 17% to nearly 50%. And that's more or less said. And then the Caitlin Mueller case also several months later also helped boost it. Though I've just seen some poll data now, and I think it's from Bloomberg, which suggests that the Paris events do not seem to have boosted support for boots on the ground among the public. If anything, it's a little bit down, which is rather surprising to me. But I think much of the media and the politicians are following the public opinion. It's not the other way around. When people are scared about something, they play to their fears because it boosts ratings and gains votes.
And as you pointed out, And you, I think you pointed out in previous books as well, John, that the chance that an American will be killed by a terrorist domestically in any given year is about 1 in 4 million, which is less than the possibility of being hit by an errant asteroid or struck by lightning, I take it.
Yes, your chance of drowning in a bathtub is about 1 in 1 million per year. And so that includes 9/11 in the calculation. So on average, over the last 30 years, including 9/11 and including Timothy McVeigh's attack in Oklahoma City in 1995, America's chance of being killed by a terrorist is about 1 in 4 million per year. And for the period since 9/11, if you just take that period, the American's chance of being killed by a terrorist is about 1 in 110 million. So it's very low. However, one of the things in the book, The Chasing Ghost book, has a thing about a chapter about public opinion. And the concerns about terrorism really haven't changed all that much in 2001. For example, there's one question. Do you worry that you or a member of your family might become a victim of terrorism? Well, at 9/11, that was about 60% said they worried about that. And by the end of the year, it had dropped down to about 40%. But it still is at 40%, even before the ISIS rise last year or this year, depending on how you want to look at it. If you ask people, another good question is asked frequently was, do you think there will be a major attack in the United States killing large numbers of Americans in the near future? On September 12th, 2001, that stood at about 70%. And it still is at that percentage. This is it. Obviously, there's never been no 9/11s. There's been very few attacks in the United States. When they have picked up terrorists, they've mostly been sort of bubble-headed amateurs. The Osama bin Laden has been killed and captured, and the hype on the has generally gone down at least a little bit in the press before the ISIS thing, of course. Nonetheless, people still maintain those kinds of concerns. If you ask people, do you feel safer than you were before 9/11? If anything, people feel less safe. And this is data from before ISIS. So just during the period of time up through and past the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden. So I'm rather surprised at that because obviously I would have expected at least some sort of erosion. And there were some questions on which there was a change during 2001 from 9/11 toward the end of the year. But since 2001, they really haven't changed very much at all. So if you're a politician, you pay attention to that kind of stuff, you find it's wiser politically to stoke it rather than to talk about it. For example, your statement about your chance of being killed is about 1 in 4 million. I've looked really, really hard, and I've found virtually no time that any official at any time since 9/11 has said that. And you'd think that would be just as a matter of responsible policy that sure. People would say that. You know, just you ought to know what the number is. Maybe you're still afraid, but you ought to know what it is. But no one says it.
Right. Well, I'm thinking of FDR saying we have nothing to fear but fear itself. I mean, you think that the commander in chief. Would want to calm people down and put it into proportion. And I think to some extent Obama's trying to do this over the hysteria over the refugee issue. But as you know, the American Security Against Foreign Enemies Act of 2005 was passed overwhelmingly today with Democrats voting with Republicans to basically pause the Syrian refugees coming into this country. And I think I talked earlier with a reporter from the Huffington Post who was covering today on Capitol Hill. You kind of have a feeling that a lot of these politicians, particularly the Democrats, were voting just to cover themselves in case something did happen, because they'd be hung out to dry. And yet again, that gets back to what we're talking about here. Whatever the next attack it's going to be, it's not going to be very significant. None of them have been particularly significant since 9/11. Some of them have been hopelessly amateurish, like the underwear bomber, etc. But the shoe bomber too, for that matter. But is that what's going on here? That they're just afraid that if they do anything that could backfire on them, then they'll, rather than do the right thing, they'll take the cowardly and expedient route?
Yes, something like that. We keep getting that argument all the time. And in both the Terror, Security, and Money book and the current one, the Chasing Ghosts book, Mark Stewart and I have looked at that really carefully. And the issue is, it's really terribly irresponsible. After 9/11, obviously, there's a whole lot of money thrown at this problem with, you know, in panic and everything. Okay, well, it's understandable, given the fears and concerns at the time and the drama of 9/11. But after a short period of time, a few years at least, you'd expect them to go back and say, well, you know, some of that money we probably spent pretty well, but a lot of it we probably spent foolishly. So we should move the stuff that we spent foolishly to areas in which you're improving public safety at a reasonable cost. And basically that has not been done during that whole period of time. The idea of acceptable risk is never really discussed. As I mentioned before, just telling people what the risks are has not been done.
So what's your sense, though, of what drives the dynamic of the military-industrial complex and now the terrorism-industrial complex, in the sense that my sense is, and this comes out of a conversation I had recently with Barney Frank, I was going on about the military-industrial complex and the contractors and et cetera, and, you know, useless airplanes like the F-35. And he said, look, it's not those military-industrial complex that people that drive it. It's the Senate. It's the people in the politicians. And they, in turn, are influenced by the press. And you know, it's this hysteria that's driven about, you know, who our enemies are, real or imaginary, that forced this thing, and that the contracts of the military-industrial complex are merely these passive recipients of all this money that's thrown at them. Mm-hmm. What's your analysis of that? Would you agree?
I would push it lower. I think it's bottom-up mostly, as I indicated, about public opinion. It's very hard to change. Let me give you an example. Obama, last January, following up after Biden, said actually that terrorism is not an existential risk, a threat to the United States. He actually heroically went out and actually said the banal, obvious thing that terrorism can't destroy, extinguish the United States. And it is true that when he said that, it didn't hurt him politically. People didn't say, "Oh, yeah, he's underplaying the threat." But it basically hasn't taken. There's no effect on public opinion, as far as I can see, even the president saying, you know, this banal, obvious thing. So the issue is, even if you try, as he tried in very limited way there, to change public perceptions, it's not clear that you're going to be able to do it. And I think the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower worried about, the problem was that Eisenhower didn't attack the premise. The premise was that the Soviets are about to launch nuclear war against us. Eisenhower himself did not think that was the case. But instead of going after the premise for why the military-industrial complex was so successful, he went after the military-industrial complex. And he didn't attack the reason they were successful, which is people really worried about a nuclear attack, et cetera, by the Soviet Union. And the same thing happens with terrorism. At least Obama's made a beginning start on that, and as you can see, it hasn't worked very well. But I've written a lot about what I call the terrorism industry, and they are acting extremely naturally, needless to say. When there's vast amounts of money being thrown at their problem, they rush right over to be under it as it drifts down like manna from heaven.
Well, actually, in the original speech of Eisenhower's farewell address, which his brother Milton largely wrote, the original phrase was the military-industrial congressional complex, and out of deference to the Congress, it was taken out. But just to touch on your book in the last few minutes here, John Mueller, Chasing Ghosts, The Politics of Terrorism, the problem is, and I think it relates to our conversation so far, which is this overreaction and this just general hysteria that is both generated by the press and appears to be out there in the land at large, this kind of propensity towards paranoia, if you will. The the thing that makes cripples law enforcement in this regard of chasing ghosts and trying to track down potential terrorists in the country, not that there are that many, that only one tip in 10,000 that goes into the authorities, the FBI or local enforcement authorities or Homeland Security, one tip in 10,000 has proven to be a legitimate threat. That's an enormous ratio.
Yes, that's right. The book on chasing ghosts, we look at that very carefully. And there's a mechanism where people in intelligence basically scare themselves. After 9/11, it was decided we'd do this thing called the threat matrix, which was to put into a big box or into a matrix every threat, every what they call threats, but what they were was tips or leads, but mainly tips. And because of the 9/11 commission syndrome, not the 9/11 syndrome, but the 9/11 commission syndrome, they decided that every single tip has to be followed up. So it's possible to calculate at least roughly how many have followed up, and it's been well over 10 million since 9/11. The number of those that have led to anything is probably well under 1,000, and many of the things that they've led to have been sort of pathetic. They were real terrorists or would-be terrorists, but they're very unlikely ever to get their act together in a competent way. So the amount of shuffling through these threats is just enormous. And it also, according to people who have written, we have multiple sources for this, people who look at it, it's every single day the CIA director, the FBI director, the president go through this threat matrix. What are the threats today? And they look at all these things, and many of them are really horrendous, you know, setting off a nuclear bomb in Manhattan and so forth. They just happen to be based on basically nothing. But if you just read this stuff, and you don't have any actionable intelligence to deal with it, the result is basically scare you. In fact, George Tenet, the head of director of the CIA for several years, says in his book that looking at those threats every single day will drive you crazy. And even the guy who's now head of the FBI, Comey, said, you know, it makes you paranoid. Or it's like playing a soccer game or a hockey game in which you can't see the other team and you can't even see the puck. I mean, it's a sort of delusional fear that's there. And a lot of it is induced by simply looking at these tips and no one saying, well, maybe there isn't anything out there. Instead, you get a new raft of these things. You don't have time to remotely keep up with them. You get hundreds of them a day that some analysts might have to try to follow up. That seems to be a process which creates what a friend of mine has called institutionalized paranoia, and that I think we've been living with. And maybe the ISIS thing is only the latest phase in that and even a more vivid one than al-Qaeda.
Well, Dr. John Mueller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a political scientist at Ohio State University and the Cato Institute, whose research areas include international relations, security studies, risk analysis, public opinion, foreign policy, terrorism and counterterrorism, and the history of dance. He's the author of Terror, Security and Money, Balancing the Risk, Benefits and Cost of Homeland Security. And his latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into whether the attacks in Paris that were designed by the Islamic State to show it had the power to influence, if not dominate, the G20 summit in Turkey may have actually ended up forging a consensus amongst the powers involved to solidify an anti-ISIS coalition.
If I had ever been it before on another time around the wheel, I would probably know just how to deal
with all of you. And I feel like I've been here before.
أكتب وخط بالقلم بالقلم أكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He serves as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean intelligence. And he has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkish Role in the Middle East, and his latest article at the American Interest is From Sinjar to Paris and Back. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And do you believe, which I'm sure you do since you've made this point, that the attacks in Paris that were designed by the Islamic State to show it had the power to influence, if not dominate, the G20 summit in Turkey may end up forcing a consensus or forging a consensus among the powers involved to solidify an anti-IS coalition?
Look, absolutely. The fact that it was in Paris, the fact that it was quite deadly, and it was important, but the fact that it happened just before the G20 essentially meant that at the world stage, they had to talk about ISIS, they had to talk about what happened in Paris, and they had to come up with a united front. But I would also hasten to add that whether or not a consensus does emerge in terms of what to do specifically will depend very much on whether or not the Obama administration decides to come up with a coherent policy. I mean, the Obama administration wants to get rid of ISIS. We all know that. But the problem is that he has until now been quite reticent to take some of the necessary steps. And I'm not saying that the United States needs to send troops and boots on the ground. The United States doesn't necessarily need to send troops, but it needs to kind of take a leadership role, which it hasn't until now. And the irony, of course, is that with the attacks in Paris, all of Europe now will be behind the United States, and there will be a united front if the United States decides to lead it. And what the United States needs to do, essentially, is make sure that the Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris, the regional powers, essentially, follow and come up with the United States with a plan. Everybody is doing their own thing at the moment when it comes to ISIS. The Turks do one thing, the Saudis do one thing, the Russians do one thing, the Americans do another, and so on and so forth. The problem with the United States is that the United States knows what it doesn't want to do, but it doesn't know what it wants to do. And so I think the administration needs to come up with a comprehensive idea of how it's going to deal with ISIS. It cannot wait any longer because clearly ISIS has demonstrated that it has a long reach. Yesterday was Paris, tomorrow it can be London. Who knows?
Well, but what is the logic then behind the Daesh, the Islamic State's, pulling off this massacre in Paris in order to dominate the G20 discussion, to show the world that not only can they not be ignored, they become the major topic of conversation? I understand that may be some kind of act of egotism, but tactically and strategically, it seems to be hard to comprehend.
Yeah, but you're asking, you're expecting for an organization like ISIS to act exceedingly rationally. I mean, they may do certain things very well, like plan an attack, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they are very good at international politics. It doesn't necessarily mean that they can always see a couple of moves ahead. And it may just be hubris. I mean, you know, the Caliph Baghdadi essentially had his moment in the sun with the Paris attacks because he could essentially upstage the G20, and he probably feels pretty good about himself. And, you know, we do know leaders who are unopposed, who think of themselves, who are absolute dictators and absolute leaders, tend to essentially, after a certain time, you know, think that they're invincible, that they do, whatever they do is right. And this may be a case, one such case. Look, it is also possible that they've been thinking about this for a long time. I mean, look, this attack in Paris was not thought overnight. It was well planned. It required probably weeks and weeks of preparation, if not longer. And so that's why I think it was time to do, to coincide with the G20. That said, they also want to show that they have a very, very long reach. They've already scored another hit with downing the Russian airplane. So this is all in a series of attacks that are designed to show not only that they're powerful, but I think it's also an attempt at showing would-be supporters, whether they are in Australia or in England or in Tanzania, that that ISIS is actually a real powerful entity, that there is a benefit to joining ISIS. I think it's as much as a recruiting tactic as it is a way of trying to intimidate others. I mean, imagine if you are somewhat sympathetic to ISIS and you see that ISIS pulls off such a major coup in the heart of Paris, and if you are one of those people who is susceptible to this kind of violence, to this kind of ideology, you will think that ISIS is pretty cool, that ISIS is pretty powerful and you should join it. So it is, to some extent, I think it's also a way of trying to show would-be supporters that there's a benefit to joining them.
So in terms of, you were just saying earlier, Ori, that, you know, the Americans do their thing, the Turks do their thing, the Saudis, the Russians, etc., and nobody's on the same page here. My sense is that that's what President Hollande is trying to do, isn't he? He's coming to Washington to meet with Obama on Tuesday and then heading on from there to Moscow to meet with Putin. He seems to be trying to get to forge a consensus or a common strategy.
Look, it's possible. I don't know what Hollande is carrying in his briefcase. But the truth of the matter is that all he can do is try to convince the Obama administration to come up with, because he doesn't have the wherewithal to offer. It's the United States that has the resources, the United States that has the capability, and what Hollande can say is, one, you know, let's push this harder, we need to do this, and then say to President Obama, look, I'm going to talk to Putin, and I'm going to try to get Putin to stop bombing the moderate Syrian opposition, which Putin seems to be doing, and have him at least cooperate in terms of airstrikes on ISIS, etc. But I'm a little bit doubtful about that strategy, because I think the Russians kind of use very blunt instruments. They're not very careful. I mean, we see they use cruise missiles that they fire from hundreds of miles away that essentially hit targets indiscriminately. So do you want to be associated with such a blunt instrument? I'm not sure. I mean, I think look, these are very complicated decisions and that require a great deal of intelligence information that I don't have. So, but I am not necessarily convinced that Hollande has a great deal to offer, except to try to convince the Obama administration to really take the lead and say, look, we are part of this same struggle and we need to move on this as quickly as possible. We can't wait. I mean, Hollande feels particularly vulnerable. I mean, this happened in Paris, right? And he knows that it can happen any time again. And the French public may be in shock now, but they will not tolerate a second set of incidents like that. And he knows that it is his presidency that's on the line. So in a way, he's doing all these things because he needs to show to his own public that he's doing something. He's extending the state of the martial law for another three, or state of siege, if you want, for another 3 months in France. So he's doing all these things. He's sending an aircraft carrier to the Eastern Mediterranean. So he needs to show that he's done everything that's humanly possible for a president, because he knows that another such attack can happen. I mean, look, they went and raided other houses, and presumably the people who were there who had suicide belts and Kalashnikovs were not did not keep them just for fun. I mean, they were going to use them. So who knows how many more such safe houses that are in Paris or elsewhere in France. So he is really under the gun. I mean, you have to look also at this from his perspective as a political leader whose presidency is at stake.
But there is a pattern in all of this, going back to bin Laden, to bait the West into, you know, acting that in ways that, you know, bin Laden thought would had benefit him, like having Christian crusader armies invade Muslim lands. And it does seem that the Daesh is trying to drive a wedge between the European and Muslim diaspora and the local residents. Here in the United States, of course, we've had that vote today that was a sort of triumph for Islamophobia in the House. And I'm not sure that such things will necessarily happen in France. But that seems to be, to my mind, you know, for example, Obama has been trying for the longest time to be restrained, but he's been under pressure to man up because Putin is bombing and you're not. You know, that's the kind of questions that the press asks. I don't know whether you heard that press question the other day. When are we going to go and take out these bastards? I mean, this is pretty obscene what's happening. And so Obama relinquishes a little bit. And the reason that they hadn't shot up those oil convoys before, which is a source of revenue for Daesh, was that they didn't want to kill the innocent truck drivers. So
right.
So now he had to turn around and blow them up just to man up, you know?
Well, but look, I mean, what is also forgotten here is that just 3 days before the Paris attacks, actually 2 days before the Paris attacks, Iraqi Kurdish forces, with American help, with American special forces and American aircraft, took Sinjar. Right? It was actually all Kurdish forces, including Turkish Kurds. And so here you had a major success where ISIS or Daesh lost a strategic town that they had control for over a year. So it isn't that the administration is not doing things. It's just that it is doing them, A, slowly, B, without necessarily, or at least they haven't communicated what the strategy is. And by that I mean, maybe the administration has a strategy that they haven't told us, but it seems to me that there isn't one because, as I said earlier, the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Jordanians, everybody's doing their own thing. If we had a strategy, then we would get them, on board. The irony, of course, of the Paris is that if the United States wants now to impose a strategy, to say, look, here's a strategy, now we want all of you to fall in line, this is the moment to do it because the world is expecting the United States to do something. And if the United States went to the regional powers and said, okay, this is what I want you to do, and they were to balk, then there's a price to pay. I mean, it's not going to be that easy for those countries to say, no, we don't want you to do this, or we're going to do our thing. Right? Because now ISIS is clearly perceived as a global menace that has to be taken care of. So the administration really has to take advantage of this moment to do something. It's not to go in militarily, but to come up with a strategy that will include much greater military involvement, but will also get the regional countries to do more. In fact, look, one of the interesting outcome of this is that Secretary Kerry announced that the United States is going to help Turkey seal the border, something we have been asking the Turks to do for a very, very long time, and they haven't done it. I mean, they can seal their own border. It's 85 kilometers or so. Why haven't they done it now? And now the United States is doing, we are going to do it militarily with them, which really means that they're going to push the Turks to send troops to the border, their own side of the border, and we will help with drones and whatever else, with aircraft, to make sure that border is sealed. But we're now saying to the Turks, you better do this. Mm-hmm. So you're already seeing a little bit of a change. The question is this part of a coherent conceptual strategy? That I don't know.
Right. Well, maybe we should send Donald Trump to seal the border. But just in closing, that obviously is not a serious question. But just in closing, I don't understand, for example, why it is that the most effective force in terms of taking on Daesh have proven to be the Kurds. And as you mentioned, they took Sinjar, they cut Highway 47, which means that Mosul is cut off from Raqqa.
That's not exaggerated. There are all these other roads that they can use. I mean,
right.
47, that road is the most efficient way of doing
right.
it, but it doesn't mean that it's cut off.
Right, but it's still, it's in the overall scheme of things, given the long stalemate, it looks like a success. But the point that I want to make is those very same Kurdish fighters have not been paid for 3 months. And you just wonder how much longer they can, support the Barzani government.
Well, the Barzani government is in trouble because oil prices are very low. The oil they ship is not, the price is too low, and they don't make enough money, and this is not exactly the most efficient part of the world when it comes to using resources and revenues. That said, it is possible that the United States and the Europeans could do with a little bit of money, they can up the end, they can improve the situation. But I actually think that more important than the Iraqi Kurds are the Syrian Kurds. I mean, they're... The United States has been a little bit hamstrung by the Turks, who don't want us to resupply the Syrian Kurds or use the Syrian Kurds to attack ISIS. And that has been the major difference between the United States and Turkey. And again, this is a moment when we can say to the Turks, look, you may not like the Syrian Kurds, but they are the effective force. They have cooperated with us. And not only that, they have cooperated very, very well with us. They have taken the Syria's territory from ISIS. And, we need them. And if we want them to continue fighting, we need to resupply them. And so that's a big... But if we supply them, the Turks are going to say, well, you're using our bases because we have access to Turkish bases, and they may create difficulties. But that's where the Obama administration has to take a much more business-like attitude and say, I'm sorry, now our priority is to destroy ISIS, and we will do whatever it takes to destroy ISIS. And the Syrian Kurds are part of the game, and we will use them. Whether they can say that is
right.
on my pay scale.
Well, Henri Bakke, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Henri Bakke, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He serves as a member of the United States State Department Policy Planning Staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And his latest article at the American Interest is From Sinjar to Paris and Back. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.